She was more than a rebel. She was a storm in bare feet. Queen Nanny of the Maroons led warriors through mist-drenched mountains, caught bullets with her hands, or so the British believed, and carved a sovereign nation from the jaws of slavery. No portrait survives, yet her face is everywhere. They tried to erase her. She became a myth. They tried to contain her. She became a spirit. This is not just the story of Jamaica's only national heroine. This is the story of a woman who turned memory into fire, and fire into freedom. Welcome to the History of the Caribbean's podcast. If you haven't already, please consider following us on your favorite podcast platform. Today, we present to you Nanny of the Maroons, A Journey Through Time, Episode 1. Let's dive into this thrilling narrative together. Chapter 1, The Whispering Winds of Ashanti. The wind speaks in Ashanti. It does not merely blow, it hums, it chants, it weeps and remembers. Long before the name Nanny would ever reach the trembling lips of British soldiers or echo through the stone halls of Jamaican colonial courts, it danced across the red soil of West Africa, whispering to the trees and the children alike, "Rise, child. You were born for something more." Nanny's story does not begin with war. It begins with a silence so deep it wrapped the forests like a secret. It begins in the womb of the Ashanti Empire, among golden tapestries and scarified cheeks, where the women bore not just children, but empires. Her name before the ships is lost to history, perhaps whispered now only by spirits, but she was born into a people who did not kneel. The Ashanti were not strangers to warfare. They did not bend to conquest. They met it with spears and spells, with drums that sent thunder across the land. In this cradle of resistance, a girl was born whose destiny would transcend continents. She was born into a lineage of Abeafo, those gifted in spiritual matters, women who knew how to speak to the dead, how to curse a tyrant, how to heal a broken body with a handful of leaves and a mouthful of words. Her grandmother, they said, had called down lightning. Her mother could look into the fire and see war before it arrived. From her first steps, the child watched the women in her village walk as if they were queens, laugh as if no man could touch them, and fight as if death itself was a nuisance. From them, she learned to gather herbs before dawn, to whisper to trees, to chant while pounding yams, and to listen. Because in Ashanti, a girl's ears were her first weapon, and Nanny listened closely. The world she grew in was not yet shattered. The men bore ceremonial gold and went to war for pride, not profit. The women wove strength into their fabrics and lullabies. But clouds gathered even then. There were whispers of white men with weapons more powerful than thunder, of betrayal, of trade deals sealed with blood. The Europeans had slithered their way into coastal lands, offering mirrors and muskets, buying flesh like rice. One by one, kingdoms around the Ashanti fell, not from war, but from within, not by blade, but by coin. The girl would come to understand this betrayal not with words, but with iron. It happened at night, as many horrors do. She remembered fire, but no warmth. Chains, but no sound. Only a quiet scream in the back of her throat as she watched her village swallowed by smoke. She remembered her mother's arms wrapped around her like rope as they ran, and how that grip loosened too soon. A club, a fall, blood in the dirt, and then only stars, wide and cold above her, a universe away from the warmth of her home. She was torn from the soil of her ancestors, ripped from the tongues that had named her. Her wrists knew shackles before they knew prayer. Her feet were dragged across dirt paths toward a coast that reeked of rot and salt. She was just a child, and yet something in her refused to break. Even then, her gaze was like a blade, cutting into the silence of her captors. A soldier tried to slap her for it. His hand hovered, and then mysteriously dropped. He did not try again. On the slave ship, language disappeared. One by one, the screams turned to moans, and then to nothing. They were packed like livestock, chained in pairs, forced to relieve themselves where they lay. Vomit and decay soured the air. Mothers died with their children pressed to their breasts. Young girls were taken below deck and returned hours later with eyes that no longer blinked. But Nanny endured. She did not beg. She watched. She memorized the sound of each wave, the expressions of each sailor, the number of days the ship turned left or right. And when the women wept beside her, she whispered the chants of her grandmother, so softly they thought it was a dream. She hummed ancient songs that made the air tremble. One woman, they said, died with a smile on her lips. This was the first lesson she would carry with her. The spirit cannot be chained. When they arrived in Jamaica, it was not to freedom. It was to a hell dressed in green. The island looked like paradise from the ship, with its rolling hills and endless trees. But that was the trap. Sugar plantations carved their greed into the land like open wounds. The sun scorched the skin of the enslaved. Their bones bent under baskets of cane. And the lash, oh, the lash made devils out of men. The overseers broke bodies daily, but Nanny watched how they feared the night. How they whispered about the hills, about the drums that sometimes echoed from the trees. She listened when old women spoke in riddles about freedom wind and spirits in the forest. And something inside her sparked, familiar, ancient, unstoppable. The girl they stole from Ashanti had not died. She had been reborn in fire. Her first escape attempt failed. She was no older than 14. A guard caught her just steps from the treeline and beat her until her skin split. They left her there, a warning to others. But that night, when a thunderstorm cracked open the sky, the guard who whipped her was found face down in the cane fields, eyes wide, mouth full of earth. No one ever claimed to see her do it. No one ever accused her out loud. But from that night onward, they called her Duppy Sister, the girl the spirits would protect. It would not be her last attempt, nor her last warning. In time, she escaped again. And this time, she did not return. The forest embraced her like a long-lost daughter. She crossed rivers chest-deep and climbed rocks barefoot until her feet bled. She survived on berries, frogs, and roots. And she was not alone. Others found her, runaways who spoke in hushed tones about freedom, about war, about a woman who could heal with her breath and make bullets turn around in midair. She was not yet Nanny, not yet legend, but she was rising, and the wind, yes, the wind, had begun to whisper her name. Chapter 2, Chains Across the Sea. The sea does not forget. It remembers every scream swallowed by its depths, every body tossed overboard, every prayer that broke apart against the tide. It remembers the weight of shackles rusting in salt. And somewhere in those haunted waters, between the cursed coasts of West Africa and the colonized bloodlands of the Caribbean, a girl sat in the dark belly of a ship, bound in chains, wide-eyed and unbroken. This was no ordinary voyage. This was the Middle Passage, the most gruesome artery of the Atlantic slave trade. And this was no ordinary girl. She had no name now, not one anyone would speak aloud. But in her silence, she carried the name her mother had given her in Ashanti, a name laced with meaning, legacy, and defiance. It burned on her tongue, though she dared not utter it. She tucked it inside herself like a blade. The ship groaned with misery. Every plank and beam seemed soaked in sorrow. Human beings were stacked like firewood, chained in twos or threes, stripped bare, of clothing, of language, of dignity. And yet, in that cargo hold of despair, a new kind of fire began to kindle. The fire of memory. The fire of rage. Nanny, though she was not yet called that, watched everything. She watched the way the sailors moved, how they yelled in strange tongues, how they struck without hesitation. She memorized every creak in the wood, every hour the bucket came for waste, every pattern in their brutality. She didn't weep. Not aloud. Her tears came in silence, soaking into the floorboards beneath her like spilled history. Beside her, women bled. Children wailed until their throats collapsed. The air was thick with excrement, vomit, and the scent of rotting dreams. Men who had once walked with pride through Ashanti marketplaces now lay limp in their own filth, some whispering prayers to gods who no longer answered. But Nanny, no older than 12 or 13, kept breathing. She kept remembering. In the choking dark, she mouthed her grandmother's chants. She whispered stories in the language of her birth, softly, secretly, so the white men wouldn't hear. She repeated them like talismans, tales of golden kingdoms, of ancestors who walked among stars, of spirits that rode the wind. And slowly, the women began to listen. They could not sit upright. They could not speak aloud. But they heard her, through the rhythm of her breath, through the hush of her voice. A dying woman beside her gripped her wrist one night and whispered, "Child, you are not meant to die here. You are meant to burn." And then she closed her eyes and left the world behind. Nanny did not flinch. She simply took the woman's story into her chest like breath and kept it. Days melted into each other like fever dreams. Food came in buckets, spoiled porridge, maggot-ridden biscuit, thin soup with the flavor of rust. They were forced to eat or be whipped. But some, many refused. They chose death over slavery. One girl bit off her own tongue and bled out before sunrise. Another mother strangled her infant rather than let the child be raised in chains. And Nanny, she watched. She watched and remembered every name, every face, every act of resistance. She would carry them all. Above deck, the sea mocked them. It sparkled in the sun, endless and cruel. A blue so deep it might have been sky. But it offered no escape. Jumping meant drowning. Staying meant dying slowly. And yet, the sea listened. It bore witness. One night, during a rare storm, lightning split the sky open like a scream. The ship rocked violently. Rain slammed into the sails. The guards shouted in panic, and Nanny closed her eyes, not in fear, but in communion. She listened to the thunder like it was an old friend. She felt the storm not as terror, but as remembrance. This was her element. The water could not claim her. The wind could not drown her song. She was part of it, child of both land and spirit. By the time the ship reached Jamaica, half of the cargo had perished. Some were tossed into the sea. Others were buried at shallow coastal plots, unmarked, unnamed, unnoticed. Nanny's wrists were raw. Her feet bled from being dragged ashore. Her back was scarred. But her eyes, they burned. Even after weeks of starvation, disease, and degradation, her gaze struck fear into the heart of one overseer. "She's got duppy eyes," he muttered. "Mark my words, this one's trouble." He was right. Jamaica greeted her not with freedom, but with flame. The sun roasted the land like punishment. The plantations stretched like nightmares, neat rows of sugarcane hiding sweat, blood, and broken bones. British masters strutted in linen, dripping with perfume and self-importance, while the enslaved worked 18-hour days beneath the lash. Children were put to labor before they could speak in full sentences. Women were raped behind barns and beaten in front of others to instill fear. But Nanny, in her silence, was studying the map of her new prison. She was sold to a planter near the Blue Mountains, a cruel man with soft hands and a cane made of ivory. He didn't beat his slaves himself. He had others do it for him. His pride was in discipline, in breaking savages into quiet, obedient creatures. But Nanny would not break. She learned the rules fast. How to lower her gaze. How to hide her fury. How to move without drawing attention. She feigned stupidity. She let them think she was slow, dull. They believed it. And in that belief, she found power. At night, she would sneak away from the slave huts and climb the edges of the forest. Just enough to breathe. To feel. There, surrounded by trees that reminded her faintly of home, she would whisper names. Names of the dead. Names of her ancestors. Names of the women who died beside her on the ship. She offered them song. Breath. Memory. One evening, an older enslaved woman found her by the tree line and grabbed her arm. "You know the old ways, don't you?" the woman whispered. Nanny said nothing. "You carry the spirits. I see it in your walk. Be careful. The British fear us most when we remember who we are." The next morning, the woman was gone. Taken. No explanation. It was then Nanny knew the truth. Her very existence was a threat. Her memory was rebellion. Her silence was war. Escape wasn't a matter of if, only when. In secret, she mapped the woods with her feet, learned which trees bore edible fruit, noted the patterns of the guards' patrols, listened to the wind, learned to follow the stars. she waited for the full moon, Ebenada, the sacred night in Ashanti belief, and when it came, she ran, barefoot, alone, into the darkness. Dogs were set after her. Whips cracked in the distance. Shouts echoed behind her. But she was not afraid. Her blood pulsed with memory. Her heart beat with the rhythm of home. She ran not like prey, but like prophecy. And when the guards returned empty-handed, the master scoffed. "Let her die in the bush," he said. "They always do." But she didn't die. She disappeared into the mountains, into legend, into freedom. And the sea, though far away, remembered her. Chapter 3. Echoes in the Hills. The Birth of the Maroons. Freedom does not come like the rising sun. It arrives like a storm, wild and unwilling to wait. It cracks through silence, topples trees, and leaves behind a world forever changed. Nanny, once a child shackled in the belly of a slave ship, now vanished into the emerald abyss of Jamaica's Blue Mountains, was no longer merely fleeing. She was beginning a life, a people, a war. The hills spoke to her, at first in whispers, then louder, then with the full voice of thunder. In those first days of escape, she was nothing more than a shadow, a ghost among the trees. She had no fire, no food beyond berries and bitter roots, no shelter but the canopy above. But she had memory, she had instinct, and she had the land. The Blue Mountains, steep and treacherous, were no friend to the colonial British. They were labyrinthine, alive, ancient. They twisted, rose, fell, and wrapped their fogged arms around Nanny like a mother reclaiming her child. The forest taught her how to disappear. It taught her how to crouch low, how to track a leaf's tremble for signs of pursuit, how to sleep without sleeping, how to listen to the rhythm of the birds to know when danger stalked. In Ashanti, she had learned how to live. In Jamaica, she learned how to survive. But she was not alone for long. There were others, always others. Men, women, and even children who had escaped before her or after her, scattered like seeds across the hills. They found one another by sound, soft whistles, coded calls, the blow of the Abeng horn carved from cow horn and carried through generations. The Abeng would become a weapon of its own, its shrill cry bouncing across mountain ridges, calling Maroons to battle, signaling danger, summoning kin. Nanny heard it first as a ghostly call in the night, echoing through the mist, and when she followed it, she found them. They were lean, wary, and barefoot, every one of them etched by pain, but still walking forward. They eyed her with suspicion until she lifted her hand and chanted something in her native Ashanti tongue. The air shifted. They recognized something in her, not her name, for they did not yet know it, but her spirit. She was not just one of them. She was what they had been waiting for. These were the Windward Maroons. Not yet a united force, but clusters of warriors and survivors hidden in the eastern reaches of Jamaica, nestled deep within the crevices of the Cockpit Country and the Blue Mountain Range. The British had underestimated them, called them runaways, thought them broken, scattered animals. But in truth, they were building something stronger than any army could imagine. A nation born not from conquest, but from resistance. Nanny listened before she led. That was her gift. She sat beside old men who had once been chiefs in African lands, listening to their counsel, learning which plants could poison a soldier's meal or heal a warrior's wound. She danced beside the women during ceremonies, letting their feet drum secrets into the earth. She learned the lay of every ravine, every secret trail, every point from which one could see the valley below, but remain unseen. And slowly she rose. It was not by decree. No crown was given. No ceremony. But one by one, they turned to her. In sickness, they came to her. In planning, they listened for her voice. In prayer, they waited for her hands to lift. She was not just a leader. She became something else, something older. A priestess. A warrior. A living echo of every ancestor who had ever chosen death over chains. They called her queen, and under her guidance, the Windward Maroons became more than survivors. They became architects of liberation. Nanny began to organize. She did not believe in chaos. She believed in pattern, in rhythm, in the old ways carried through blood. Camps were arranged with careful attention to the terrain. Lookouts were placed in trees. Children were trained not only to run, but to signal. Even food gathering became strategic. Roots and wild yams were planted across trails, so Maroons could survive even while on the move. The British called it bush magic, but it was genius. She taught them how to build from nothing, how to create homes that vanished into the forest, huts woven from leaves and reeds, kitchens that used smoke tunnels to hide the fire, medicine huts laced with herbs that masked the smell of blood. She taught them how to use the land as armor. Rivers became escape routes. Caves became armories. Trees became watchtowers. And the forest? The forest became their most loyal ally. But Nanny's power was not merely tactical. It was spiritual. She carried with her the sacred knowledge of Obeah, the ancestral practices of African spiritual power, brought over in whispers and shadows. Her rituals were not parlor tricks. They were acts of war. She conjured protection through powder and prayer. She walked barefoot into sacred groves and returned with warnings of enemy movement before any scout could report. Some say she could hear the future. Others believed she spoke with the dead. And then came the stories. Stories that British bullets could not pierce her skin, that she could catch musket fire between her thighs and hurl it back like curses, that she stood on mountaintops, arms outstretched, summoning fog to blind the redcoats, that she could walk into a battle unseen, untouched, untouchable. The British dismissed these stories at first, called them superstition, called her a witch. But the more soldiers they sent into the hills, the fewer returned. The survivors came back trembling, speaking of traps laid with impossible precision, ambushes where no path had been seen, enemies who vanished like smoke. They began to fear her name, Nanny. It rang through plantation quarters like thunder. It danced on the tongues of enslaved children. It was carved into the minds of every runaway who dreamed of the mountains. She had become a myth, but one rooted in blood, bone, and battle. A living legend who breathed. Her base became known as Nanny Town, perched high in the Blue Mountains, hidden in the clouds. It was a sanctuary and a fortress. It was a place where the enslaved became sovereign, where the broken stood upright again. Here, songs of Africa were sung freely. Drums echoed through the night without punishment. Children learned to chant their ancestors' names. And warriors trained, not just to fight, but to free. For Nanny's war was never about revenge. It was about restoration, of dignity, of memory, of a people stolen and scattered now finding each other in the hills. She trained women to fight, not as auxiliaries, but as equals. Women who had once been branded and beaten now learned how to set traps, wield machetes, and use the terrain as a blade. Nanny believed in the power of the feminine divine, not as gentle, but as fierce. Her warriors were not an army. They were a family. And every blow they struck carried the weight of the ancestors behind it. And though they had no flag, no formal declaration, no army by European standards, make no mistake, this was war. A war against an empire. A war that would not be won in a day, or a year, or even a lifetime. But one that would be remembered. Because freedom has echoes. It lives in the hills, in the whispers between trees, in the soft hum of the Abing at dusk. And in the center of it all stood Nanny, queen of the Maroons, mother of rebellion, and living proof that even in chains, the spirit cannot be conquered. Chapter 4, Fire in the Forest, the Call to War. There is a silence that comes before a fire, not of peace, but of calculation. The kind of silence where every breath is measured, every footstep careful. And every eye scans the horizon for the spark that will ignite everything. In the high ridges of the Blue Mountains, that silence had settled like mist. And in its center stood Nanny, her eyes narrowed, her jaw clenched, her bare feet rooted into the mountain soil, as if she were part of the land itself. She had watched for too long. The raids, the kidnappings, the children taken, the trees burned, The forest was crying, and Nanny was listening. The British had become bold, arrogant. Their muskets echoed farther into the hills. Their sugar wealth fattened their pride, and their hunger for total domination swelled beyond the plantations. What they could not tame, they tried to destroy. They believed the Maroons were nothing more than scattered nuisances, pests hiding in trees. But they had made a fatal miscalculation. They had mistaken patience for weakness, and they had pushed too far. It began with a child, a girl no older than 7, who had wandered too close to the edge of a plantation searching for wild yams. A soldier found her. The details were never fully told. No one needed to hear them all to understand. When they brought her back to Nanny Town, her body limp, her tiny hands clutching a ripped cloth, Nanny did not cry. She only stood, still as stone, while the others wept around her. Then she turned, walked to the ceremonial rock at the heart of Nanny Town, and placed both palms flat against it. "The fire has waited long enough," she said. "Now it will burn." And so began the war. But this was not the kind of war found in European history books. There were no open fields, no cannons in rows, no uniforms gleaming in sunlight. This was war in the old way. It was war spoken in chants, in ambushes, in traps set by moonlight. It was war waged by those who knew the trees as kin and the rivers as allies. Nanny called her warriors together, men and women alike. They circled her beneath the starlit canopy, their breath misting in the cool mountain air. No torches burned. The forest did not need fire to see. They waited reverent as Nanny stepped into the center and lifted her voice, not in English, but in the rolling syllables of her Ashanti tongue. The rhythm of her words danced with the night breeze. "This is no longer a place of hiding," she said. "This is a place of becoming. The mountains are not our prison. They are our fortress, our blade, our breath." She raised her hand, and the Abeng horn blew, a piercing, mournful note that cut across the sky like lightning. "To the ones who came before us," she called out, her voice rising like a wave. "To those chained, to those killed, to those who leapt into the sea and chose death over bondage, we do not forget you. We become you." That night, a dozen raids were planned. Every Maroon village would act in unison. No plantation within reach would sleep easy again. The British awoke to fires devouring their cane fields, the night lit with orange fury. They ran barefoot across scorched earth, shouting orders that the forest mocked with silence. Watchtowers collapsed under the weight of sabotage. Horses bolted, terrified by the Abeng's cry. And always, always, there were whispers. "Nanny is watching. She never struck in the same place twice. That was her genius." One night, a sugar mill would be reduced to ash. Days later, a slave driver would be found gagged and strung up in a tree with "Freedom is breath" carved into the bark. Entire plantations became ghost towns, abandoned after too many accidents, too many unexplained vanishings. Nanny Town became the heart of a growing resistance. Those who escaped from slavery did not just flee to the hills. They came seeking her. They carried stories, wounds, rage. Nanny listened to each one and gave them new names, new lives, new purpose. A man who had been forced to whip his own brother became the chief of a guerrilla unit. A girl who had watched her mother hang became a trap builder whose designs killed dozens of soldiers. And still, Nanny remained more than a leader. She was legend. Her presence made the air feel heavier, sacred. When she walked through camp, warriors stood straighter. When she laid hands on the sick, they healed. When she meditated by the river, the water stilled as if listening. Her power was not only spiritual, it was psychological. She understood fear. She used it like a weapon. She had her people plant dolls carved from bones in plantation fields, their faces twisted into snarls, their bodies marked with red pigment. The British called it witchcraft. The enslaved called it hope. And when the British soldiers destroyed the dolls, they did so with shaking hands. Nanny had her warriors mimic owls in the night. One hoot, danger. Two, retreat. Three, strike. Entire attacks were coordinated by birdsong. The Redcoats never understood how they kept losing. Maps failed. Roads vanished under mudslides, engineered by Maroons. Traps snapped bones. Arrows flew from nowhere. The jungle, once seen as an obstacle, had become a living, breathing army. And Nanny? She never stayed in one place long. She was wind, mist, fire. There was one raid, spoken of in hushed reverence, where she led a team into the heart of a heavily guarded estate. They moved at midnight, crawling through cane fields slick with dew. Nanny walked barefoot, eyes glowing. They reached the overseer's hut. Inside, he snored, drunk on rum and power. She entered without a sound, stood over him, and whispered in his ear, "Your gods do not live here." He woke screaming. His beard had been cut, a maroon blade resting on his chest. But no blood was shed. Not that night. Nanny wanted him to tell the story, to let fear do what steel could not. The next morning, that plantation's slaves refused to work. They sang songs of Nanny instead. And so the British grew desperate. They sent scouts, militias, mercenaries. They burned forest edges, poisoned rivers, cut down trees. But it only made the Maroons retreat deeper, stronger, more dangerous. Every act of violence became another reason to fight. Then came the retaliation. They captured a boy, no more than 10, a Maroon messenger. They tortured him for information. When Nanny found his body, discarded near the riverbank, she didn't speak for 2 days. She fasted. She knelt beside the water, her fingers tracing symbols into the mud. When she finally rose, her eyes were colder than death. "They will bleed," she said. The next raid was no longer symbolic. It was retribution. Her warriors struck not just the cane fields, but the barracks, the armories, the guards, the overseers. Flames rose like wings. Screams echoed down into the valleys. And when the smoke cleared, Nanny left a note on the gate of the estate, written in perfect, deliberate script. "We are not afraid of your chains. We are the fire. We are the wind. We are the storm you cannot kill." From that moment forward, war was no longer whispered. It was declared. The British called her insurgent, rebel, sorceress. The Maroons called her mother, queen, deliverer. She called herself nothing. She needed no title. Her existence was resistance. Her breath was revolution. Her heartbeat drummed with every name she had carried from Africa to Jamaica. The forest had chosen her. The spirits had anointed her. And now the fire had been lit. There would be no going back.